Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Access Closed. My guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield, and we're going to elaborate even more on the income sharing agreements that we talked about recently. So, Steve, is this going to be a real problem with the student loan debt crisis?
Yes, it is. It's on an upward curve now, directly proportional to the advancing of the student debt crisis. And as college costs and the need to take out loans to make it possible for anybody but the wealthy to attend on the scale that they need to be taken out at today's costs relative to the average incomes of the families that are seeking social mobility by helping their children get through college. That's just getting worse and worse and worse. And so people searching around for any kind of alternative to, traditional bank loans, we're creating a sizable, vulnerable population that is looking for something, that could be better for them than traditional banking. Now, we've been discussing for a very long time now that one of the biggest issues for traditional banking and the kinds of government programs that subsidize and distribute traditional banking as a way to get loans to attend higher education is that those kind of loans are tethered to your credit rating, right? They're just an ordinary loan. If you're late paying them back, you're never going to buy a car, you're never going to buy a house, you're never going to get married, the whole bit, right? So that's the risk that people are seeking to avoid. What's creating that vulnerability, knowing that anything could happen, even just a dramatic increase in the price of gasoline or fuel oil, like we saw in the early 2000s when they went to 4.25 a gallon at certain points, and your home energy and commuting costs would double, and now suddenly you can't pay back your student loan, and your credit rating is destroyed, even though you had a decent job and were living within your means. So people aware that that's something that's always looming, especially student loans, which differ from car loans and home mortgages in that they are issued at a time when the person taking out the loan does not have any income, right? That's by definition. You're only speculating that you'll be able to repay the loan. You're 18 years old, and you're not going into the work world. You're going into college. You do not yet know what your income might be when you leave college and work and have to start paying back these loans. So student loans are a particularly fraught and frightening kind of loan within the traditional credit system. And so what we've been seeing now, although it's not getting any play in the media whatsoever, is that there is arising because of, the income gap, income inequality, leaving some people in this country with substantial cash reserves, looking for better returns on their investment than just keeping it in their bank account. They're now going through basically what's essentially loan brokers at the colleges themselves, at the university financial aid offices themselves, to connect incoming students with people of high net worth, people with substantial cash reserves, who are offering to pay for their college out of their own pockets, paying for these students' tuition and fees out of their own pockets in exchange for the student agreeing that upon graduation they will, just send a check for 10% of their income, not a fixed amount every month, but 10% of their income. So if somehow a college graduate, due to some special skill, ends up, let's say somebody like me, right? When I left college, I went into music. Let's say by some strange accident of fate, over the next 2 years, I got landed a great record deal and had a hit record and suddenly had become a rock star. I would have been owing 10% of everything I was making to this person who had invested in my college education, even if it came to, $1 million, like 100 times what I had actually borrowed from the person. It's a fixed percentage rather than a fixed amount. So yeah, if you're making very little money, you don't have to worry that 10% might overburden you. But if you're making more money, a lot of money, you could find yourself in a situation, you know, based on that roll of the dice, where the person who lent you the money is actually exploiting you for many multiples of what they lent you in order to be able to go to school. And you're taking on the risk of whatever that entails, because you can see when you're looking at your prospective future finances, when you're only 18 and not planning to enter the work world for at least another 4 years, that the risk to defaulting and having your credit screwed up for the rest of your life is rather high. And so you become vulnerable to looking for other options. And so now this basically, it's a light form of indentured servitude, right? You literally owe a private person a percentage of your income for a 10-year period after you've, you know, completed your education. And it's the financial aid offices of the colleges themselves that are facilitating the interaction between incoming students and potential investors in their future incomes. This is, you know, maybe I'm calling it indentured servitude light, but it is quite literally a form of serfdom, right? Traditional feudalism serfdom, right? In serfdom, in the feudalism days, the nobility owned all the land, right, around their castle, and their income came from taking 10%, the actual same figure, right? Serfs would come and farm the land and pay a 10% fee to the nobility that owned that particular land for being allowed on the land in order to farm it. And the land was so substantial that by taking 10% away from every farmer, the nobility was incredibly wealthy and powerful. They used that money, you know, to pay to secure their positions, right, to have armies. And, you know, it's an ugly, ugly thing. It is perhaps maybe better than indentured servitude. Maybe the better analogy is that this is a return to feudalism. People who have excess wealth that they cannot use to generate any additional income for themselves are tethering poor people to owing them 10% of their livelihoods when they complete their education. And of course, this doesn't, you know, change if you don't graduate, right? Let's say you don't finish school and you don't gain the average income boost that finishing college is expected to provide you. Now you're really in a pickle. Now you're really in some really big trouble. You remain tethered to that wealthy person that extended the loan to you for the same 10 years, no matter what's happening. So why this isn't part of media discussion, why every high school guidance counselor is now starting to actually offer this for high school parents to explore as part of preparing to send their children to college, instead of everyone recoiling in horror and saying, my God, don't do this. Look what's happening. We're actually degenerating and devolving from capitalism back to feudalism right in front of our very eyes as a direct consequence of income inequality. And, you know, some of us barely living at a subsistence level, with other people having so much surplus revenue that they can't even figure out how to invest it anymore. You know, like, that's where we are. So that's what the topic that we're talking about today is about, because I am quite positive that most people listening to this conversation will never have heard of it before right now. So, you know, we needed to define it and explain it.
So who is the genius that thought this up?
I don't actually know that. I don't know if there was a specific person. You know, the business community is full of these geniuses, right? The lending community, the banking and finance. That's how we, you know, came up with things like derivatives that destroyed the whole financial system a decade ago. There are people at investment firms whose job it is, just like people at any kind of firm, is to create new products, right? Like create a new kind of toothpaste that whitens your teeth or, you know, freshens your breath in some way other than the already existing forms of toothpaste, right? This is just ordinary product development in the financial services industry. People are paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for creating successful, what that industry calls investment instruments, things that didn't previously exist, that could be used as an investment with a good return on the dollar for the investor, you know, above the rate of inflation, above the interest they could get if they just left the money in the bank, right? That is the function of product development in the financial services industry. So I don't know if it was one person who came up with this or a team, or if it just was a natural area to explore just in the course of the ordinary function of this particular profession, and if numerous people came up with it simultaneously. But at this point, it is already an institutionalized financial instrument that people with surplus net worth are investing in. They're investing in SERFs. You know,
in other words, let's take this closer to home. Mary Lou Whitney had just passed away. Mary Lou was a very wealthy woman. She would be one of the people who would engage in something like this, correct?
Yes, well, not even any individual, but some of these people are not like people who are billionaires that are offering this. They're just people who, you know, have financial advisors, right? You know, when you have so much money that you have a financial counselor that you turn to show you things like how to invest in tax shelters and things like that, right? That's a big profession now. So you don't have to be as wealthy as, like, you know, the heirs to the Payne Whitney banking fortune and all that kind of stuff to be engaged in this kind of stuff. In fact, that's the weird part about it, is that the facilitators of this within the financial aid offices of the universities that are doing it are actually making direct contact. They're soliciting people saying, would you be available to fund our students' education? You know, and people are responding to that, saying, yeah, put me on the list. I'll be one of the people that's available to that. So you don't really have to be, you know, a billionaire to be in the game of investing in SERFs. You just have to have a lot more money than you need to live, and a financial advisor that's pointed you in the direction of this as something that pays, you know, on average a higher rate of interest than something else you might invest in. You know, you'll probably find this stuff starting to happen in pension funds and other institutional investment packages, mutual funds, pension funds, you know, imminently as it gains popularity among students as a substitute for traditional loans.
But the fact is, you know, you're telling me this is a standard practice now, you know, for people who are going to college, and it's not well known, and hopefully this broadcast will make it more known. So if it branches out into different segments of society, that's not good, right?
Yeah, no, it's terrible. And we have you know, no track record whatsoever in the United States of nipping anything in the bud. We don't address anything that happens that goes wrong until, you know, long after the negative consequences have manifested themselves. And so, you know, an example, right? The time that elapsed between when science recognized that the lead in gasoline was being burned and put out in the air, and that this was causing mass neurological harm, and when we finally banned leaded gasoline, was 60 years. It took 60 years from the emergence.
Wow.
And you can see what's happening right now. Scientists started talking about that the burning of fossil fuels had risen to such a degree that the composition, the greenhouse composition of the atmosphere was being altered by human activity. Back in the 1950s, the first congressional hearings with scientists about this that projected the same timeline that they're still projecting now was in April of 1980, okay? So depending on how you want to look at it, the first time science put the public on notice that we were facing this problem was 70 years ago. The first time that our own Congress held a hearing to investigate the science and the timeline was 40 years ago. And here we are, since that 40 years ago, the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere have accumulated by an additional 150%. The inactivity of Congress goes on unabated. So this is the same kind of thing, right? We even if people start noticing this right now, and recognizing that serfdom is incompatible with capitalism and with, you know, personal, you know, individual liberty and everything we believe in as Americans. They'll first notice that maybe around 20 years from now, when the size of the population seeking out this kind of college financing becomes on a scale similar to that seeking traditional banking loans. And then it'll take us another 60 years to decide whether we want to do anything about it. That's my cynical observation, just looking at, you know, all of the terrible things, right? The iPhone came out in 2008, 2007. How many years did it take before some states started passing laws making it illegal to use them while you're driving? You know, like how many thousands of people? It was like 100,000 people that had been killed by the use of cell phones in cars before anybody started, and it's still not universally legislated that it's illegal. So I don't really know what the prospects are for an accelerated timeline between getting the reality of this new kind of college finance out into the public discussion and when or whether anything can be done about it. Look how long it took to get the problems with the traditional student loans. You know, when did Biden first create this non-exemption for student loans from bankruptcy protection? And when, you know, major candidates first started talking about, let's see what we need to do to alleviate the downward pressure this is putting on the American economy. Like it took ages to even be a discussion, and it's still treated as a fringe position, right? Oh, Bernie Sanders is into it, AOC is into it, Elizabeth Warren is into it, right? It's still so this relief of the downward pressure on our economy that we need by relieving the student debt crisis is still not close to happening. It's being talked about, but it's still not close to happening. And so how long would the lag be between this conversation you and I are having and when candidates first start talking about it, and then when it becomes not a fringe position, you know, and then when something potentially might be done about it, you know? And that's not to say, as we discuss all the time, that we should despair and not talk about it, right? Because the day did come when leaded gasoline was banned. The day did come, you know, when we understood that cigarettes caused cancer. The day did come when, you know, states started making it illegal to use your phone while you're driving, right? You know, or so the day, you know, does sometimes come. And the only way to be positive that the day will never come is to not talk about it, is not try to do anything about it. So don't take my cynicism about timelines to be a suggestion on my part that this is a waste of time. It's just to illustrate for people the magnitude of what we're dealing with as we do. Like, you have to, in order to be effective, you have to understand the magnitude of the thing that you're trying to bring to people's attention. You know, and so that's why I talk this way.
You're talking a huge magnitude. You're talking millions of people that might be sucked into a situation like this. You're talking about it. I'm listening. We're doing a broadcast about it. But I don't see this being talked about anyplace else. So therefore, there are a lot of, and I hate to use the words, but I think it's the proper word, there are a lot of suckers out there buying into this, right?
Yes, and that is actually going to increase. You know, tragically enough, the fact that the traditional bank loan problems are now getting significant airplay, are now being put in front of the public, is actually only going, in the short run, that's going to actually raise people's susceptibility to this new system, because as people, you know, listen to this debate in public, they're going to, you know, people who might not have been afraid of taking out a traditional banking loan will, at least in the short run, the number of people who don't want to take out a traditional bank loan is going to increase. And as they become aware that there are alternatives to traditional bank loans, they're going to be looking to that, because it's not like they're going to be looking at not going to college at all. They want to go to college. So as the fear level, as the public fear of traditional bank loans for college is raised by the success of the student debt crisis in entering the political discourse, yeah, there's going to be a sudden uptick in people seeking out this other system because they didn't have equal information provided to them about what this new system is and how it's not better than the one they're trying to avoid and in some ways is worse.
Now, the two candidates that have been talking about it are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Have you seen, read, or heard anything that they've said on this particular issue?
No. They actually haven't said anything on this issue. There are no candidates anywhere for, you know, state office, federal office, the presidency. There are no candidates anywhere that make any mention of this. I will encourage, any candidates that I become aware of, you know, which of course are going to, you know, be identified within the Green Party, within, alternative parties, to address this and try to make it a public issue because, you know, I am encouraged by the fact that people are now talking about the Green New Deal and it's only, you know, it took until 2016 for people to talk about it and the Green Party started using that terminology in 2010, which was not really a very long time lag. So I think it's possible that if I speak to people that are running as minor party candidates this year for Congress about bringing this forth as something that differentiates alternative party politics from what we see on CNN every night, that who knows, you know, six years from now, then maybe, you know, some progressive rebel within the Democratic Party, like an Ayanna Pressley or, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, will start talking about this, you know, neo-serfdom, whatever label, whatever catchy name we decide to put on it, will enter the mainstream. But it's certainly not going to enter the mainstream if non-mainstream political advocates don't start talking about it, in a meaningful way. And that's something, you know, that people in alternative politics are receptive to because, you know, you want to clearly distinguish what a voter would get by voting for you from just being like, a super Democrat or a super Republican, you know, if you're on the libertarian end. Something I've tried to articulate in my own candidacies to just tell people, no, I'm not here drawing votes from your preferred candidate. If you look at my platform, you will not find a single thing on it that's on the Democrats' platform. If you look at his platform, you will not find a single thing on it that's on my platform. We're utterly and completely different from each other. And, you know, as much different from each other as a Republican would be from a Democrat, you know. People that are, you know, looking to get that public attention, that entrance in alternative political campaigns, generally that's effective strategy. And like we were saying, there are occasions all throughout history where that approach of bringing something into the political discourse will later end up translating into someone in a mainstream party who's looking to access votes that have, you know, aggregated around that concept, you know, like Franklin Roosevelt did with all the proposals of the Socialist Party back in 1932. So we should be talking about that. We should be making that an issue for 2020 for people, and especially libertarians, right? This is not a left-wing issue because what could be more anathema to a libertarian than a person becoming a serf to another person? Because of a financial obligation, right? So there's no specific, left or right wing component to this particular question.
The fact that this is now policy in a lot of colleges and a lot of people are participating in this, how pervasive do you think it is?
It's still actually in a pretty early stage. It's probably amounting to only like, 2 percentage points of everyone taking on outside financing for their college. So it's not big relative to traditional loans at this time. But, that's the reason why we're talking about it now. Is the whole too big to fail thing, right? Once this becomes something that a significant portion of the investment class is deriving interest from, then they engage lobbyists, in order to preserve the system. We all know how this works, right? If it's same thing that people are saying about for-profit health insurance right now, right? They're saying, well, if we undo the system, all these people will lose their investments, all these people that are employed by them will, if you let something become entrenched, if you let it actually become problematic to unravel it and disengage it, then you can't disengage it, So it's very, very important to not treat it as, oh, that's not very big of a problem. It's a big problem. It needs to be treated as a big problem because there's still time now to do something about it. If we let it grow to say 10% of the total financial obligations that incoming college students are taking, it'll be too late to unravel it. The lobbyists will already be in the game. The people complaining that they would lose income and it would harm the economy, they'll all be in the game. And so it's important to act before that happens.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one final question in this broadcast, Steve. The people that's participating in this, do they realize that they're participating in feudalism?
No, because we don't educate ourselves on that concept. People, for the most part, aren't really sure whether they're participating in capitalism. they're just looking at, here's an issue that's on the table. Here's a way I can make money. We don't have that kind of framework, like, is this a socially acceptable way to make money, right? None of us, very few of us actually think that way. How many people look at their pension funds, their mutual funds and things that they're investing their 401ks in and go, oh, I don't want any oil companies in there. I don't want any military industrial complex, in there. Right. I don't want any big Wall Street banks in there. Hardly anybody, steps back for a second and tries to take some socially responsible view of what they may or may not be engaged in as part of the discussion. They want to know its rate of return. They want to know, they're not being, philosophical or theological about what it's doing. It's weird. I had I was up in Albany a few days ago for an environmental rally, the day of the State of the State address. And some guy on my way back to the car, we were on our way home, pulled up in a pickup truck, and he said, hey, this thing that you want to do with green energy, is it going to be handled by the government or is it going to be handled by the private sector? And all four people I was walking with, as if we were prepared in advance for the question, we all said at the same time, both, right? And the guy said, well, you can't have that. You can't have the government involved in that. And I said, why not? Who do you think runs the fire department? And he said, we have private fire departments. And I said, no, we don't. There's no private fire department anywhere in America. And he says, well, I'm not from Albany. I'm from a small town nearby here, and we have a volunteer fire department. And I said to the guy, yeah, I'm a volunteer firefighter. And it's public. It's not private. The only difference between paid and volunteer is that the firefighters themselves don't get paid. I said to the guy, who do you think buys the fire trucks? Who do you think buys the diesel oil for the fire trucks? Who do you think pays to build the fire station where the trucks are? The taxpayer does. It's a public system, and it's successful. He didn't even know it. He thought his local volunteer fire department was like a private institution, not part of his local government administration. So we as American people are not informed about this.
Steve, our time is up for today.
Okay.
So we'll continue this discussion at a later date. So you've been listening to Steve Greenfield. This is All Exits Closed. And if you like the show, follow us on Twitter, All Exits Closed. Dee, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great
day.
Thank
you. You too.